Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello, out there. I used to frequent a busy bar after work hours where I'd read a paperback. I was single at the time and not wanting to return to an empty apartment, so I would go get a few drinks, order some sweet potato fries, and enjoy myself by myself. And there's an incredible power in that, being clearly alone in public and embracing it. Most couldn't imagine going to the movies or a restaurant solo, but I'm here to tell you that if you embrace it and learn to truly enjoy your own company, life can be greatly experienced alone. That paperback of mine, I believe it was a Dean Koontz book, Whispers, if I remember correctly. I eventually read it, but not at the bar. Something I discovered is that people can't help but approach you when you seem to be enjoying yourself by yourself. People just have to know, what is this person all about? It's attractive, a clever tool, the most subtle and ingenious trap in any con man's repertoire, confidence, and the air of mystery. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. Mysterious George. The boy was as bright as they come, able to spin any perceived weakness into a strength through the art of charm. Born in Florida in the year 1958, George Russell Jr. never got the chance to be around his biological father, with whom he shared a name. George's mother, a college professor, would leave George's father, deciding to flee Florida when the boy was still in diapers, and marry a rich Seattle dentist, moving George into a lavish lakeside home on Washington State's Mercer Island. Once in school, it became obvious to the boy that he did not fit in. George was black, while his classmates were white. George was also smaller than most of the others. But he was intelligent, and quickly found ways to endear himself to the island. It seemed that George didn't like being at home much. His mother and stepfather had jobs in Seattle and weren't on the island constantly as George would be. His mother was a professor of black history and culture, while his stepfather built a dentistry career into one that made George one of the richer children on Mercer Island, a place where money, and coming from money, meant almost more than the color of your skin back in the 60s. George, from an early age, began showing off an impressive inherent skill, charm. Charm being a mix of confidence, humility, good humor, and timing, young George Russell was full of it. which often helps him being charming as well, being full of it. In one example, he managed to impress the island's small police department so greatly that he became like a mascot of the station. The boy initially found his way there by getting into trouble, hanging around parks too late, or doing mischief like playing pranks or sneaking into the local movie theater. It wasn't unusual for a cop to find Georgie walking the outskirts of the island in the rain and give him a lift to town. The affable little boy chatting away happily all the while, never complaining that his clothes were soaked or his feet were tired, seeming to only want to spread good cheer. Inquisitive as hell for a little boy, and incredibly self-preserved too, never speaking too deeply about himself, always putting others in the spotlight of the conversation. It's hell to not know why you are as a child, and difficult to find out who if you don't care to know yourself. In the beginning, he had a dog, a big old St. Bernard that would drag him around. Quite the sight, and not something the folks of Mercer Island would soon forget. "Have you seen that little black boy with the dog?" they'd say. Rain or shine, they'd be out walking, Georgie making a name for himself from the start, being so friendly to everyone he'd meet, remembering names and bits of information he'd call back effortlessly on reacquaintance. Eventually, after many run-ins, the local PD developed a soft spot for Georgie, the charming little guy that never seemed to go home. They took him in. He started with odd jobs around the small Mercer Island Police Department and became such a fixture that cops would take him for the occasional ride-along, a practice that empowered the kid and improved his standing among his peers. The cops checked in with the parents. There was no crime here, but it was concerning that the boy avoided speaking of his home life and stayed out of the house as much as possible. It appeared his mother and stepfather were quite busy with their careers, but also there was a baby, a little girl. So maybe that was most of it. Also, it seemed that Georgie's mother didn't care to care for George much now that she and the dentist had their own child, a sister that George grew to love dearly. And as he grew into a young teen, would happily spend time with this sister when his parents needed him home to watch her. The dentist himself would tell police that as far as he was concerned, Georgie was lucky to have the life he had, and that he easily could have been left an orphan. So, the cops took him in. Georgie basically grew up at the police station, spending any free moment there, not wanting to be home unless it were just him, the dog, and his little sister. It is said that he looked up to the officers greatly, and that when an officer of color entered the force, he'd shun them, only seeming to idolize the white policemen. This was an interesting wrinkle in the story of young George Russell. Classmates would say he seemed to despise being black, that any mention of his race would raise his hackles. George would grow to feel that his skin color was holding him back when it came to relationships, especially with young women. Sure, he would be invited along as a token, as a way for the rich kids of Mercer Island to demonstrate in this time of the civil rights movement that they were on the correct side of history. But none of the girls had any real interest in being with George romantically, for fear of what their fellow socialites might truly think. This wasn't lost on the bright young man, and there is a seed here that would root and poison the soil of young George Russell's fertile mind. But it wasn't everything. He was never quite right. Anyone who spent enough time with Georgie would find this out. He kept everyone at arm's length, always curious and willing to go deep about others and their strengths and struggles, but quick to steer the subject from himself. Georgie, you see, was quite the charmer. Everybody liked him. He never shared about himself, though it was clear a lot was wrong with the young man's life. When his mother eventually left the dentist and the island for yet a greener pasture, a teaching job in Maryland, taking George's sister, whom he cared for deeply, George didn't seem to flinch. He claimed that he could have left too, but had chosen to stay. Something that the dentist, left to care for a child not his own, would make clear was not the case to anyone who asked. With George's mother out of the picture, the dentist soon had another woman, a white woman whom George took a liking to, and for a while, life seemed to actually improve. It was when he turned 16 that things began unraveling. The sweet, charming little boy of the island, now 6 feet tall after a growth spurt, was growing into a menace. The Mercer Island PD decided they had to get rid of George when private criminal information on other teenagers started becoming public. It was clear who had leaked the records, but you never could get an honest answer out of the kid. Even when he was caught dead to rights, he'd behave as though nothing was the matter. Georgie seemed to take his banishment in stride, but in truth, he was deeply hurt. Rejection from his father, his mother, and now his relationship with the Mercer Island PD had severed. As a result, it seemed George was turning away from authority after having been enamored by it for so long. He dreamt of being a detective. Now he would use everything he'd learned from his unusual tenure with the police against them. Georgie began a low-level criminal enterprise on the island. Drug deals, alcohol sales to minors, car hopping, B&Es. And soon enough, he found himself back at the police station quite frequently, being processed for an incredible amount of juvenile crime over the remainder of his teenage years. By 20, George was on the streets. Apparently, he'd been making unwanted sexual advances towards his, what would you call her, the dentist's wife? His house mom, I guess? For years. And now finally the dentist had had enough. George had always bragged about having a white mother, but it seemed that he had pushed himself onto her at times and tried to develop a romantic relationship. George didn't sweat being kicked out of the house. He knew the island so well by this point that he could live off the land. If he needed a car, he'd steal one. A place to stay? He'd simply find out who was on vacation and take over their house until they returned. Returned to an unmade bed, an empty fridge, and a sink full of dishes. The young man was absolutely incorrigible, treating Mercer Island like his personal playground until eventually he began catching serious cases and was no longer in any position to talk himself out of it, though he tried. If you caught George Russell sleeping in your bed with the TV on, he'd start complimenting the thread count of the sheets, then ask if you'd like to watch a movie. He'll make the popcorn. And the crazy part is, for a long time, up until things got too serious with George Russell, the people and police kind of put up with it, because they liked Georgie, felt sorry for the orphan of Mercer Island, a sympathetic character that you might find driving down the street in your car with your jewelry on, but hey, that's Georgie. He'd laugh it off and give it all back. A strange time in a strange place. A truly unusual background check. Mercer Island was so affluent, and George Russell was so well known and liked, that many didn't even complain about his early crimes. They saw them more as antics. George Russell had somewhere along the way become the wayward child of all. Looking back, it's plain to see that the serial killer who had come to be known as the Charmer had them all fooled. Though maybe it was more than that. Maybe they could sense the danger beneath the many facades of who some referred to as Mysterious George. And the odd reception to his unacceptable behavior was perhaps more self-preservation than enablement. As he approached 25 years of age, the whole act got old with him. George wasn't fooling anybody anymore. He was drinking, doing drugs, getting sloppy. Pins in his hip from crashing a car hobbled him from running away from crimes as well as he once could. George was being arrested constantly and only able to talk his way out of half of it. He was hitting on married women, lurking around in the shadows, peering in their windows at night. It's fair to say that the charm, by the early 80s, had long worn off. Mercer Island had had its fill of George's bullshit. The old St. Bernard he still walked around with knocked a 7-year-old kid off his bike and bit his face, which led to George's last true friend being put down. Desperate to turn back the clock and get in the good graces of the Mercer PD again, George started providing information that led to the arrests of acquaintances across the island. It wasn't like George could snitch his way into a detective's position, though he maybe thought it could be that easy. George Russell was low, but he went even lower when he started hanging out with 14-year-olds, mostly girls, sneaking around and playing cool guy with them, never letting them know he was in his late 20s, playing the whole Mysterious George game again. He, of course, would manipulate the girls into sex with him, but the main thing he couldn't stop getting caught for, and that the parents of Mercer Island were completely fed up with, was George buying alcohol and providing drugs to their children. He would serve 7 months as a repeat offender, and it was in the late 80s, after he got out, that the creepy break-ins began. A slender black man was repeatedly being seen in homes in the dead of night, simply looking over people while they slept. Sometimes he'd steal some jewelry, but for the most part, the intruder seemed to be content to simply break in and prowl around. Everyone knew it was George, but because he'd always get away and he'd cause no harm other than scaring the shit out of those who woke up to him standing in their doorway, not a lot could be done about it. The cops couldn't arrest George Russell just based on his skin color matching the prowlers, but they sure wanted to, as they were convinced it had to be him. After all, at this time, George was about the only man matching the prowling black male's description on the entire island. Plus, it seemed like the type of thing he'd do at this point of his criminal career, reveling in the power and control he'd lost so much of over the years. Prison doctors had dubbed him a likely psychopath. Today, they more likely would have categorized him as antisocial personality disorder, characterized by impulsive, irresponsible, and often criminal behavior. This personality diagnosis fit George until he decided to branch out to surrounding areas where he could really begin pushing his limits. He'd grown bored of the whole routine, as had the police and the citizens of Mercer Island. It was time he grew up, stopped playing games and repeating the same old lies. He'd been reading up on Ted Bundy, had heard of the Gainesville Ripper back in his home state of Florida. George Russell Jr. was finished pretending. He wanted to feel himself for once, find himself. What was he all about? Really? The intoxicating prospect of serial killing solved the riddle of Mysterious George. And when it was over, at the very least for the perplexed residents of Mercer Island, it all finally made sense. But to others it didn't. Privately, many knew George to be kind, an excellent listener, intelligent and gentle. I've always found it fascinating that a killer capable of extreme violence could at times be tender too, and not even in a manipulative way, truly just a genuinely nice person to be around at times. When George began hanging out in the nightclubs of Seattle after basically being run off of Mercer Island, just about everyone who would later recall meeting him said he was just the most charming young man they'd ever met, always buying tables rounds with a $100 bill. The money and the bits of jewelry he'd sometimes hand out was a result of George's continued habit of breaking into houses, and not a perk of being an undercover cop with a dangerous side involving shady deals, as he'd have people believe. His hobbies were beating others badly at chess and studying true crime. Leading up to his own short-lived serial killing career, Mysterious George had displayed open fascination in the Green River Killer case and discussed it excitedly at any given opportunity. George grew his fingernails long and was known to be involved with cocaine, though everyone was back in the late 80s, especially in the bars and clubs. Those long fingernails, though, they became a trademark of his. You'd always know when George was coming up behind you as he'd run them quickly down your spine before meeting you with his wide, disarming smile. Women recalled him being a gentleman, even shy when the opportunity for sex arrived. Though it was said by many of the girls he was with that he pushed to give oral sex and would often overdo it. In truth, there are many women he'd manipulated and abused, robbed and cheated, but George had a way of always smoothing things out. He kept to himself while simultaneously managing to develop an instant and strong rapport with anyone and everyone he met. George would be in the club reading a newspaper while everyone partied around him, something I talked about in the beginning there. That's a technique that worked like a charm to draw all the attention his way. The police scanner, intermittently crackling on his hip, helped too. He'd claim to forget it was on. Silly of him to blow his cover as a secret agent. In truth, George used the scanner as a way to know where and when to strike, then run, following one of his creepy break-ins. Mysterious George, indeed. Nobody could figure his age. He looked to be in his early 20s, though his eyes and demeanor said 40. Most understood him to be an undercover cop, in the club to ensure the safety of patrons. This was a rumor George himself had spread, and eventually, even the club owners believed it. He was treated with respect by bouncers and bartenders as a result. He became a fixture. And because of his respectful behavior with women, on first sight, in the clubs and such, George Russell was about the last guy anyone was looking at when the bodies started showing up. He would use the bars and the clubs that he was now a known entity in as his traps. Back on Mercer Island, it never would have worked. He'd used up that scene as a training ground of sorts. George Russell Jr., by the summer of 1990 and in his early 30s, was finally ready to become what deep down he'd known he was for a while. The time spent studying police work, the years of getting into trouble just to exercise the muscle of talking his way out of it, the break-ins, where the main possession he'd gained was a sense of power and control, standing over the lady from the bank or the man from the insurance office in their homes while they slept, standing silently over them, like death. Anywhere George roamed, there followed a large influx of strange incidents. People waking up to the sounds of an intruder in their home, scaring the prowler away, then later hearing tapping on the window. In one incident, a door handle fell to the floor. Another, the pictures on a wall were removed. A woman woke up to being tied to the bed. When the dark man in her room had subdued her, he simply looked over his handiwork, then left. He was like a ghost. Some people, with some of the shenanigans he was pulling here, thought that they had a poltergeist in their house. George was known to be into the occult, known to do little ceremonies with himself, play with Ouija boards and such, and it's thought that maybe he wanted these people to think that there was a wraith, a ghost, in their homes in these break-ins. It was as if he wanted these people to feel fear, and that was his reward. Also, he was building up to something. All of this mystery of George, a racist nickname he'd ignored all these years, by the way, Mysterious George, like Curious George, he'd let it slide. He'd laughed it all off, taking it easy on them, really. When the people at the club started to catch on to George, same as those on Mercer Island had, cracks began to show in the facade. If you wanted to see the real George, the angry, mean, murderous creature that lurked within, you only need to do one of two things. Push a holiday celebration on him. Something about the desertion by his biological parents set him off badly on the subject. But the other thing you could do to piss him off was to see him clearly and call him on all of his bullshit. The less he was able to disguise his true nature, the more powerless he was to keep it shackled. In the end, George was reminiscent of a road-weary Ted Bundy, bedraggled from the years of slaughter, the pressures of constantly shape-shifting. George himself was tired of pretending, and finally it was clear what it all had been for. George Russell, like Bundy, was born to be a serial killer. And what a relief to finally know what he is. Rosetta Stone, everybody. Rosetta Stone is a leading language learning program available on desktop and mobile, designed to fully immerse you in your chosen language for a more natural and effective learning experience. I use Rosetta Stone, and my favorite aspect of Rosetta Stone is how you can learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally. It helps you think and communicate with confidence. There's no English translation, so you truly learn how to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. They have an intuitive learning process. You start with words, you build to phrases, and you progress to full sentences. And it's designed for long-term retention, so what you learn sticks with you. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
June 23rd, 1990. A McDonald's parking lot of Bellevue, Washington is swarming with police in the early morning after a body is discovered in front of a trash compactor. The metal teeth of the compactor have blood on them. It's an incredibly strange crime scene. For one, this McDonald's parking lot is surrounded by bars. The nightlife in this area would have been quite alive when the body was left here, leaving this an unusual place to commit a murder, let alone dump a body. Beyond the bars and surrounding streets lay acres of concealing woods. Why would a killer choose this area? Did they want the victim to be found? She is posed. The blood on the compactor indicates that her killer had originally planned to run her through the machine, a trash compactor for the McDonald's that would have been turned off overnight. And if this sounds odd, crazy even, that a large push-button metal-toothed trash compactor would be sitting in a busy parking lot all day where, say, children could get curious and start playing around with it and end up pulped like a Stretch Armstrong toy in today's YouTube videos, then I must remind you that this isn't today. This is 1990. So yeah, they had an automatic trash compactor sitting 20 feet from the play place at McDonald's on standby to horrifically maim curious kids. But back to this. There are abrasions on the body that indicate the corpse had been dragged here before being lifted to lay in the mouth of the compactor. When the compactor proved disabled, the killer appears to have become remorseful, having swept up a spot on the ground with a broom found near the scene and reverently laid the body down. The victim, a young woman and local student of 27, later identified as Mary Ann of Redmond, Washington, is white, around 5'8" and 125 pounds. She has curly reddish-brown hair of medium length. She is naked, save for bright pink nail polish, a gold necklace with a white pendant, and a gold watch. She had been strangled to death. Chips from her pink nails are found in her neck where she desperately grabbed at her throat to relieve her killer's unrelenting squeeze. There are bruises and blood on her head and face. One detective describes her face as being a little off-center and that she looked like she'd been in a minor traffic accident besides the naked and deceased part. Oh, and the posing. The victim is laid out as if in a coffin, ankles crossed, wrists crossed on the chest. The hands hold a pine cone. Over one eye is a plastic lid for a Lay's potato chip container. It appears as a last thought the killer tried to send the victim off properly, using trash. At autopsy, it will be discovered that she'd first been murdered via strangulation, then brutally raped after death. A rough object had been used anally, causing tearing, while the perpetrator had raped the corpse vaginally and ejaculated. The young woman had at one point been kicked so hard in the stomach that her liver had been lacerated by her spine. It is a brutal murder, performed by what investigators are describing as a sadistic necrophile. George Russell Jr. is clearly the perpetrator. It's kind of the reason why we spent all that time getting to know him. He'd recently been kicked out of the Black Angus, a nearby club, and the previous night he'd borrowed a friend's truck while out drinking at another nearby club, and didn't return the truck until the morning of his first victim being discovered. The truck, a red 4x4 pickup, apparently smelled of death and had to be washed several times by the owner to even dampen the smell. George claimed he'd vomited up clam chowder in the vehicle, but that wouldn't account for the large blood stain on the passenger seat. This victim, along with the other victims that are to come, the details of her that I have aren't the best. The way that they describe these women are, well, there's a book that I've read on this that is from, you know, I think it's like the late 90s. And they have no problem really describing the woman in a kind of a negative way. That's the reason why I haven't used the last name here. But some of the details on her is that she was known as a dick tease, quote, rude. She would lead men on and get, like, you know, drinks and things off of them and then just not deliver on kind of what she's promising. She was known as Hot Mama, called herself Hot Mama. She was openly known not to be into African-Americans, blacks. There was one story that I read on her that when she did get into bed with a man after teasing him relentlessly, she would lay there and behave robotically to kind of ruin the experience for them and get... some kind of joy out of that, the way that she was behaving with men. And again, that's why I haven't included her last name. I don't think it's fair, but I think that I need to include it just so you kind of know the type of woman that he's going after here. It doesn't make it right, but it's an interesting aspect to the case that all of his victims that he chose were types that he met at the bar, and they were known to kind of be like teases. In the early morning hours of August 9th, 1990, a couple of months later, in a quiet Bellevue neighborhood, three young men out camping in their backyard hear a blood-curdling scream come from a house owned by their 35-year-old neighbor and single mother of two children, Carol Marie. Again, most of the information I have on Carol seems to run in a derogatory fashion to her character, so I'm just sticking with first names. I see no reason to potentially shame a single woman living her private life when some piece of shit decides she should die for it because it sets them off in some way. But here's what we know. She was a waitress at one of the clubs surrounding the McDonald's where the previous victim had been found. Carol's 13-year-old daughter, she'll wake up in the middle of the night to a flashlight in her window. Her 9-year-old sister is asleep. The prowler begins shining the light in all the windows, and the 13-year-old says she too falls asleep like her sister soon after, thinking it must be one of her mother's boyfriends being weird or something. This little girl doesn't hear the scream that the boys camping outside hear. The next morning, the girls go to wake their mother, but her bedroom door is locked. The 13-year-old makes her way outside to a glass sliding door that leads to her mother's bedroom and finds the door open. Looking inside, she sees her mother naked on the bed, save a pair of red high heels on her feet. There is a pillow over her face and a shotgun between her legs. The girl runs out, goes to the phone, and calls her father, who arrives soon after at around 9 a.m. He has casts on both arms from a work accident and can't believe he's having to deal with some nonsense at this hour. He hobbles up to the sliding door, takes one glance at the scene, and closes his eyes. He believes, with that one look he got, that his ex-wife has shot herself. Investigators are summoned, and when they take a good look at the scene, it's clear that this isn't a suicide. Someone, George Russell Jr., had broken in, beaten and strangled the woman to death. He knew the victim. They'd not gotten along for some time, and the brutality of her murder showed just how much Mysterious George was now deciding this would be his way of venting a lifetime of perceived rejection. When the pillow is removed, it's revealed that the victim's face is wrapped tightly with plastic, the stuff used to protect clothing at the dry cleaners. She died in a blitz attack, likely woken from sleep while being beaten with an object that left cattle prod-like impressions on her, like burns. George bit her arm viciously at one point, likely after death. He raped the corpse, ransacked the room, which held quite a bit of jewelry, then posed the body so it faced the bedroom door, and then inserted the barrel of the victim's shotgun 5 inches into her vagina. She had had a shotgun under her bed for protection, but was asleep when the attack began. Lingerie is folded neatly on the bed. It appears as if the killer wanted to dress the corpse, but settled for putting the red high heels on the feet. It is a despicable, disgusting scene, and authorities are starting to fear that they have a serial killer on their hands, one just as vicious as the former Seattle Terror, Ted Bundy, whom had just been executed the previous year. And they will have to hurry, these investigators. George is starting to like this, and is motivated to not only match the vicious nature of Bundy, but his prolific pace and victim tally as well. George continues to surround himself with acquaintances. He's staying in a large motel room and packing it with as many young party people as possible. He talks incessantly about the murders, ridiculing the investigation. He even has newspaper clippings covering his crimes, tacked to the kitchen wall. There is a picture of his first victim with the words written in red by George that say, well, the word, it says, "Help," in all capitals. It's disturbing. Those who think they know George begin to feel concerned about his mental health. He's so focused on murder and mayhem and taking an unnatural interest in these cases, but again, they chalk that up to him being an undercover cop, which he isn't, but they believe he is. He's getting blind drunk, something he rarely would do leading to the summer of 1990. In one incident, George is hauled out of a Denny's at 3 a.m. after slamming his head off the table and walls over and over. He claims to be under a lot of pressure in his work as an undercover agent. George will consistently leave the party once it begins to die down, put on all black clothing, grab a small hit kit, and claim he's gotta go do something. Friends assume the something is shady drug business. Some even believe that George is a secret narco agent, as he wants them to think. But in reality, George is hooked on the act of the prowl. It's estimated that he breaks in and burgles close to 100 homes that summer, murdering 3 carefully chosen women along the way. 3 weeks after his second murder, on August 31st of 1990, a prowler is spotted in the upper middle class neighborhood of Kingsgate in Kirkland, Washington. It is just before dawn when a veteran firefighter, up early with his coffee on the back deck, spots a dark figure moving in the shadows at the end of his lawn within some trees. Recently, the fireman had been contacted in the night by his tenant, 24-year-old Andrea Levine, who lived in the basement apartment of his home. Andrea had claimed that a man was at her window, and the fireman had gotten up immediately to check it out, knowing about the string of break-ins the area had been terrorized by this summer, not to mention the 2 horrific murders he'd heard the disturbing details of through cop buddies. That night that she called him, he had found nothing, but this early morning he sees the figure in the brush, and this causes George Russell to go running for a fence when the man yells out to him, jumping into a garden, then making his escape. 3 days later, the fireman, his name was Bob Hayes, he's installing motion lights around his house when he notices his tenant's cats milling around the basement apartment door. He knocks to see if Andrea is okay. Her car's there. She should be home. Suddenly concerned, Bob asks his wife to get the key and go in and check on Andrea. Bob doesn't want to do it himself, as a man going into a young woman's space seems inappropriate. Mrs. Hayes hesitantly agrees, and when she enters the basement apartment, the smell is the first thing that greets her. There's also a television blaring in Andrea's bedroom. It appears she could see through her open doorway that the young woman is in bed back there. She calls out Andrea's name, but the blankets covering her fail to stir. Entering the bedroom, Mrs. Hayes sees that the blankets are over Andrea's head. The bedroom is dark, save the flickering light of the television, and the scene is just a little too foreboding for the woman, so she calls her husband, Bob, to come in. Bob enters the apartment, face screwed up from the smell, and when he sees the shrouded form in the bed, tells his wife to back out. Bob calls out to Andrea. Again, no response. Bob approaches and slowly pulls back the blanket. A wacky 80s car commercial blasting in the background. A copy of the book Misery sits on the nightstand. When he sees the girl's head, he's seen enough and is ushering his wife out of the apartment, then running into the house to call for police. Investigators quickly figure out that the killer had accessed the apartment through the garage, which was left open slightly so the cats could get in and out. Andrea had been blitz attacked in her sleep. Her brains are left spilling from her skull after having been beaten to death with a blunt object. The petite young woman is naked and spread-eagled, and I'm not sure where to start here, so I guess I'll get the book out of the way. Not the Misery, I found that interesting. I was reading Misery at this time, 1990 around there, I think. I was about 10 years old. Just setting the scene, I guess. But there's another book. It's titled The Joy of Sex. It had been a gag gift from one of Andrea's friends, but clearly George had found it amusing as well. He's tucked it in the crook of her arm, as if it were a prized earthly possession of the girl's. To drive his point home about his opinion of the victim, George has shoved her vibrator down her throat. The body is covered in shallow stab wounds. I mean covered. Around 250 wounds that have been neatly and precisely pierced into the entire body, even the soles of her feet. He even started to play a game of tic-tac-toe with the blade on one of her breasts. The anus has been penetrated brutally with a knife. What's happened to the body with all the little stab wounds in it is something called picurism, a fascination by some killers. Killers like Andrea Cicatillo, Albert Fish as well, play with the body and stab it over and over again once dead. And it is an absolutely brutal crime scene. The 3 days that have passed in the warm basement apartment don't help things much. A semen stain on the floor is collected. The young woman's hands are bagged to preserve any skin she may have ripped from her assailant with her fingernails. In the kitchen, a set of knives are missing from a knife block. The killer had likely used one of these for his enjoyment of piercing the body, and then, once he finished poking at her with the knife over 250 times all over her body, he had taken the whole set of knives with him, knowing that it would make it more difficult to match a blade to a set if they didn't have the set. There are no prints. The killer wore gloves, though there are some long marks on the victim's back that look like fingernail scratches. Besides the semen on the ground, it appears that George Russell picked up some tricks from his days with the Mercer Island Police. Investigators are morbidly impressed by the state of the crime scene. Even the most grizzled of vets have never seen anything quite like it. When the news of Andrea's murder hits the news, there are female friends of George that suddenly have alarm bells ringing. They whisper and gossip about how George has a connection to all three victims. Everybody knows everybody's business in the club scene, and these three women had been of the many who'd rejected George over the years. But with Andrea, they knew that he tried to break her door down after an altercation at the club one night. It had been a running joke since the killings began that mysterious George was the one responsible, but nobody really believed it. Waitresses, bouncers, bartenders, and clubgoers were now convinced George actually had something to do with what the press was now calling the East End serial murders. George Russell had never been taken seriously by the many police that were familiar with him. But when the calls continued to come in regarding George, and a closer look at George's history in Mercer Island, along with conversations with officers of that police department, happened, it suddenly became quite clear that George Russell should be considered a suspect, maybe even a prime suspect. When investigators start talking to people about George, they are overwhelmed by the nature of the information. People who know George seem convinced it's him. Women, especially. Some even share that George has been openly stalking them, tapping on their windows at night, breaking and moving stuff around. But until these murders started, they chalked it up to George being George. The guy was just so damn strange all the time, so mysterious and consistently off the wall that people had gotten used to his odd behavior. Much like the phenomenon that had occurred on Mercer Island during his youth, where everyone seemed to just accept that George Russell was going to break in your house, or steal your car, or try to suck blood out of your neck while making love to you. Yeah, he'd do all kinds of nasty shit. Too many odd sexual kinks to cover for this story. It was long enough. But you get the idea of the acquaintances of the club scene and the never-ending stream of young people partying at his secret agent den slash motel room had simply decided that it were easier to consider George a character than what he obviously truly was. The cops, they were guilty of it too. They just gotten used to him. They had some trouble tracking him down. It seemed word had gotten to George about the interest in him for the murders. It's like he evaporates. But he will appear in mid-September at the window of a female friend. He knocks on the glass and smiles wildly when she comes to the window and is clearly scared by George standing there, in the dark. She tells him to go away, and the smile disappears. Soon he's trying the door, then more windows. She calls the police and they arrive in a flash. George has a screen of one window half pried off when the lights hit him. But he's tired of running. George Russell gives up easily and is brought in. And for a while it seems he'll be quite difficult to crack. This is the best part for him. The chess game. George has been talking his way out of trouble his entire life. He figures this will go away the same as it always has. A friendly chat, then a release, maybe a couple of months in prison if they get him for the attempted burglary charge. But when that truck he'd borrowed for the first murder, the one that smelled like death and George said it was clam chowder, when that truck was finally looked into, and the now faded stain on the seat was dug at and samples of the blood tested, they were matched to Marianne from the McDonald's parking lot. A ring that George had given to a female friend recently was handed over to police. The girl was suspicious as to where George got it, now that he was an open suspect in the East End murders. It is soon discovered the ring belonged to his final victim, Andrea Levine. And I guess I'm saying her last name and not the others because there wasn't any real truth to her promiscuous activity as much as the other ones. It was an overload of examples of their promiscuity. And I just don't think it was fair to say their last names when there was a lot of that there. Andrew Levine, there wasn't anything like that. He had just become pissed off at her from a single rejection recently. The semen from all crime scenes is eventually matched to George, and it's a massive relief to everyone who'd ever known him when he's eventually sentenced to 2 life terms. I will wrap this up quick. When the judge asks if the condemned has anything he'd like to say, something incredible happens. George Russell Jr. simply shakes his head. For the first time in his life, there's nothing to spin. Nobody to fool. No appearances to keep up. The mystery is gone. And it seems the young man is happy, relieved, for people to finally know who he is, what he is. Though the why, he will keep for himself.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.